O God, open our hearts to your gospel, your good news, a gospel by your Spirit will pass swiftly and faithfully from our ears to our hearts and from our hearts to our lives. Amen. Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and we have lit the candle of hope. But hope, it seems to me, is the ugly stepsister of the trinity of eternal virtues Paul listed in his first letter to the Corinthians. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Love dominated the life of Jesus as described in the gospel and is absolutely central to the Christian message. And I cannot begin to count the number of sermons I have heard on the topic of love. And faith? Well, faith arises in every book in the New Testament, and it's a foundational doctrine across the entire Christian theological spectrum. But hope? Hope is also a core element of Christian teaching and life, but one that frequently lives in the deep and dark shadows of its more famous siblings. It's easy to talk of love and faith when the sun is shining and when we have the wind at our back, when all is right with the world. But what do we do when we enter the dark valley of despair and the storms of life threaten to destroy us? When faith has died and love seems like a cruel joke at our expense? When we are so bruised and shattered that we can hardly make it through the day? It is then that hope dares to whisper its message. It quietly works its way into our broken world like a dandelion forcing its way through a crack in a concrete sidewalk. Maybe, just maybe, it won't always be like this. Maybe the future can be different than the present. It is in this context that the words of our first reading are placed, and when the Hebrew messianic hopes were first born. The great biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann has compared this week's passage from Isaiah to the I Have a Dream speech of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But most of our days in our lived reality are still a long, long way from either prophet's vision of healing, justice, and peace. When we close our eyes and listen to the words of this dream, we do so with heavy hearts, thinking of the increasing polarization and vitriol of our politics, the devastation of the refugee crisis around the world, and the deep anger coming from those on both the left and the right who for decades have felt that no one is listening to or cares about them and their pain. We've come to understand the absence of peace in other ways too, in the damage to the earth that we will leave as a tragic legacy to our grandchildren and to theirs as well. Melting glaciers, superstorms, mountains of plastic in the ocean, and earthquakes around the world. We have to begin to wonder if nature itself is at war with us. Not that we could blame it if it was. If we are honest, though, these difficulties are not only global, but they're also close and personal. They are in our city and in our neighborhoods. They are in our homes and in our workplaces. And they are in our relationships with one another, in our families, and even within the walls of our parish. Perhaps we can then begin to imagine how the people of Israel must have felt over the centuries in the face of threat, destruction, and exile by one empire after another. More than 500 years before the time of Jesus, they listened to Isaiah's dream, this vision of the future, and they looked around them at their once beautiful city, Jerusalem, burned and battered by powers that must have appeared unstoppable. Still, they chose to cling to their trust that the covenant that their ancestors had made with God was more powerful and durable than any empire or any destructive force. This week's passage in Isaiah's recitation of God's promise of a future was very different from what was visible just then. A future that would be enabled by a Messiah, by God's anointed one. As with most people of their time, the Jews of the time of Jesus linked politics and theology. Firstly, their God, Yahweh, was the one true God. All other gods were idols of human creation. Secondly, the fact that the one true God was their God proved their election. They were God's chosen people. Yet from the time of their return from their Babylonian captivity, the Jews had remained in the land they believed God had given them, but always ruled by a foreign empire. Thus, in the minds of most Jews, even though they were physically home, from a spiritual and a political perspective, they were still in exile. And as such, they continued to wait fervently for God's vindication through a Messiah. By the time of Jesus, there were two primary streams that shaped messianic hopes. One that followed a priestly track stemming from the order of Melchizedek, and another that followed the royal warrior track tied to God's promises to King David. Both the temple and the royalty of the day were commonly seen as pawns of Rome, as corrupt institutions far removed from their days as God's instruments of justice. And it would have seemed reasonable that God would have sent his Messiah into either the house of Herod or the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. But no, God's Messiah, God's answer, came to a scared teenager from a nobody family in the backwater of Jewish society, Nazareth. Can anything good come from there? Part of the wonder and difficulty of hope, of God's hope, is that God's response, God's answer, frequently comes in ways that are very different than our expectations. So there are words of comfort and of promise about what God is going to do in the midst of so much suffering in our words from Isaiah. So much longing, but along the lines, there's also a call for us to participate in bringing that beautiful dream of God to reality. We suspect that both Isaiah and Dr. King expected us not just to sit around appreciating the elegance of their words and waiting for that great day of peace and justice to arrive, but to work, actively work, as we wait for its fulfillment. Isaiah wants us to loosen our grip on our swords and our instruments of war and to take up the things of peace, to walk in the light of the Lord. It all sounds really nice, but as Brueggemann says, there is of course a catch. God wills for the world a center of justice and righteousness that will get our minds off of our own petty agendas and our penchant to protect our own private investments. I find this vision overwhelming and personally a little bit frightening, because the things I value most, I am most reluctant to lose or risk, and even more reluctant sometimes to share. The things of war between nations are also the things that we struggle with, each one of us, individually. In fact, the hardest call for us to answer may in fact be in each individual heart, rather than focusing only on the larger issues of what happens out there. But I'm reminded of the famous quote by Charles Schultz. I love humanity. It's people I can't stand. It's so easy, so human, for our hearts to grow entangled with petty resentments and even larger hatreds, born of frustration and disillusionment. We find it a tremendous challenge to move through times of discouragement and even oppression without losing our souls to such terrible wrongs, such powerful impediments to peace. And we have to ask, what are the little investments we protect? Isaiah actually promises a time when God's ways will fully shape how all of us live. Every single person, all nations, many peoples, streaming towards the bright light of peace. And enough for all. It may not look like it, but Advent is about taking the long view of things. In the meantime, we are reminded that God invites us not just to imagine and dream, but to work towards making that dream a priority in our everyday lives. Paul's word in our second reading continue the theme of God's creative transformation of the world. All time, according to Paul, is sacred. And God's vision is on the horizon, calling us forward. Salvation is nearer than we thought. God's wholeness is just around the corner. Or it could already be here, and we need to be prepared. We need to be mindful of the moment-by-moment revealing of God's presence in our lives. Divine omnipresence means that in ways large and small, domestic and dramatic, God is always with us, and in all times, in saving ways. The Apostle Paul calls us to act as if God's realm is here, right now, to become a citizen of heaven in our everyday lives by our commitments, values, and actions. Jesus' word in our gospel text complement Paul's word in Romans 13 and Isaiah's vision. According to biblical scholar Bruce Epperly, this passage from Matthew's gospel ultimately is more about mindfulness in the present than a specific prediction about the future. Stay awake. Holy moments may catch us by surprise, and God is coming to us in every encounter, in our everyday lives. We need not wait for a world-transforming catastrophe or a spectacular second coming. Creative transformation, awakening to God, and living in God's realm is available to us all the time, but only if we are open to it. The future is in our hands as well as God's, and we need to prepare, moment by moment, to experience God's vision of shalom. God's provocative possibilities are embedded in every encounter. Jesus and Paul's words challenge us to live faithfully. We are to have a lifestyle of expectancy. We are to live as God is, as if God is with us, precisely because God is. If Jesus, Paul, and Isaiah could dream of peace and lift up the vision for us, we too can dream the dream of peace and rearrange our individual lives and the life of our communities, large and small, to be peacemaking communities of generosity, justice, and joy. Communities of listening, of self-examination, of acceptance, of change, even if that change is not easy or fast. We can't do this on our own, but God makes it possible. Grace enables us to accomplish so much more than we can imagine, because it is God who, by the power at work within us, is able to accomplish abundantly far more than we can ask or imagine. As we steep ourselves in Advent observances and look forward as much as backward in time for inspiration and hope, we are called to quietly consider what we truly long for in our lives and the price we are willing to pay for it. To ask what it is we hope for and in what our hope is grounded. Looking at our lives, let us reflect on how we have constructed them to protect what we have as individuals, communities, and nations. Haven't we often beaten our own personal and communal pruning hooks into spears in order to protect what we claim as our own? In the coming weeks, as we write our Christmas cards and sing our Christmas carols with their lovely messages of serenity, grace, and good wishes, if we take the time to listen, we may hear a call deep in our souls to pursue peace in our lives and in the world around us. Not just to talk about it as if it were a sweet but unattainable utopian ideal, but as a genuine hope that the future may indeed be different than the present. During this season of Advent, we can take real, concrete steps to heal division, alienation, and broken relationships in our families, our communities, and in the world, if we have the courage to do so. And thereby we can bring Isaiah, Paul, and Jesus' vision of peace and justice to life, beginning with just one step, one relationship, perhaps one apology. We are truly invited to hope and believe that we can be part of God's dream. Amen.